Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday, August 15th. 57 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. And 58 degrees in the Heber Valley. Real quick update, though. We've got a major traffic delay there in Interstate in Parley's Canyon on Interstate eastbound with a traffic accident about a mile east of Lamb's Canyon, which is slowing traffic all the way down nearly to the base of the canyon. But we've got some great weather in store, and on the phone with us, we've got Cedric Haynes with meteorologist with ABC4. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. And yes, we do have some wonderful weather out there. A comfortable start to the morning with these temperatures down into the 50s and low 60s out there. And of course, we're seeing lots of sunshine, so some nice sunrises developing out there. We're going to stick with that sunshine throughout the day, but make sure that you keep that sunscreen with you and apply it and apply it again, because we're going to be looking at those sun values pretty high. And that means that we could have you could burn if you don't have that sunscreen SPF 30 or greater in less than 15 minutes in the direct sunlight there. High temperatures today in Park City will likely climb into the lower 80s, and in the Heber Valley area, we're going to be climbing closer to 90 to 93 degrees. So it is going to be a warmer day because it's going to be a drier day out there across the area, and dry air heats up quickly during the afternoon hours. Now, as we go into your Friday, expecting more of the same, lots of sunshine out there in the Heber Valley. We actually may see temperatures dip down again back into the mid to upper 40s early in the morning on your Friday, but don't let that fool you. That dry air is going to heat up quickly, so we will climb back to the lower 90s by the afternoon hours with plenty of sunshine expected across the area for your Friday. And in Park City, we'll start off with temperatures around the 50 degree mark, climbing into the low to mid 80s during the afternoon hours. But for your Thursday and Friday, looks like we're going to be looking at dry conditions, as any rain chances will be pushed well to our north and northeast as you get over to Idaho and Wyoming. So that's the good news. If you have any outdoor plans, looks like our Thursday and Friday will be looking good. Now, as we go into the weekend, get ready for more changes, because our winds will switch from out of the west to out of the southwest, and that brings back that monsoonal moisture coming in from the south. So we'll look for our rain chances to start ramping back up as we go into your Saturday and Sunday. Now, the good news is we're not talking about a complete washout during the day. I don't think we're going to see a widespread deluge of rain, but there will be pop-up afternoon showers and thunderstorms developing. So if you're going to be doing any recreating, whether it's in Park City or down in the Heber Valley, just know that the chances of pop-up storms return in a big way as we go into our Saturday and Sunday. But again, not a complete washout, but just have a way to check the radar and get weather alerts if you are going to be outside during the weekend time frame. We'll keep that chance of pop-up showers and storms in the forecast for the area as we go into your Monday and Tuesday, as we continue to see that monsoonal moisture moving into the area. Again, not complete washouts, but they will definitely have pop-up storms each day before we start to dry things out again as we head towards the middle of the week. Temperatures will stay at seasonal levels, with temperatures in the 80s to low 90s for highs over the next 7 days. So, Leslie, enjoy the nice weather, though, for our Thursday and Friday. We've earned it after this busy start to the week.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much. And on the phone with us now with our weekly trails report, I have Laura Anthony, Executive Director of Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy Thursday, Park City. This is a quick one. All we've got is a notice that the Saturday morning, there will be the Mid-Mountain, it used to be the marathon, now it's the 50K, is going to be running from Deer Valley through to the canyons and the Utah Olympic Park. So there will be trail impacts there on the Mid-Mountain Trail. That's it. It'll be rolling the beginning. They're beginning, I believe, at 7 a.m. at Deer Valley's Silver Lake, and they roll out toward Utah Olympic Park. If you're early in the morning, stay away from Deer Valley. If you're late in the morning, stay away from the more northern side of the mountain. Looks like trails in Wasatch County are all doing great, running well, and Park City Municipal Ranger Joe wants to remind us that we have a bunch of fire mitigation happening right up out of Old Town. So right now they're working in the Ontario bypass area, so the kind of Tour de Suds part of the trail system. So good place to stay away from. They're going to have chainsaws and felling trees, and we've got 400 miles of trail, so maybe find somewhere else to play today. Stay cool, and that's it.
Okay, so no damage, no reports of damage then due to the rain and hail and wind we had earlier this week.
Yeah, no, I was out there on the trails yesterday, and they are in really good shape. I'm sure we have blowdowns, so if you're out there and you see a tree that's crossing a trail, just send us a pin drop. Actually send it to rick@mountaintrails.org, and we will get a crew out there to remove trees. But other than that, the rain was much needed, and we'll be back to working on new projects with this moist soil. We're actually able to build trails. The moon dust doesn't do so well with new trails. So anyway, yeah, it'll be a great day. And if you have any news for us, it's rick@mountaintrails.org or Laura, L-O-R-A, @mountaintrails.org.
All right. Thanks so much, Laura. Stay tuned. In just a minute here, we'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong, taking a look at yesterday's meeting. Park City School District parents Josh Mann and Carl Person have an update on their petition, asking the Park City Board of Education to wait until next year to consider the superintendent's employment contract. And the founder of Sage Mountain, Lauren Lockie, has details about their upcoming barn fundraiser. The Summit County Council met yesterday, and in the studio with a recap, County Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's see, the major topic, I think probably that joint discussion about West 200 South. This road is also known as the Old Camas Highway and the Gun Club Road. The Wasatch County Council joined Summit County to discuss the construction traffic on this road from Toohey and Wakara, which is causing problems for Summit County residents on the road. Summit County Attorney Dave Thomas at one point said closing the road as Summit County has considered, would obviously lead to litigation. So is that crash gate that the county council initially favored off the table for now?
I don't know that it's all the way off the table. We're trying to explore what possible solutions might be, and we had Wasatch County in with us yesterday, members of the Wasatch County Council, Dustin Graybaugh, who's the county manager, along with the developer of Wakara. And that's, I think, where some of the questions would arise as to what we can and can't do. We had this discussion. It started earlier this year, or maybe even late last year, when residents in that area came in and said that there are safety hazards there. They've got large dump trucks, large construction traffic making its way up and down that road. The dust is unsatisfying for them and harmful. Kids playing anywhere near the road presents a significant issue. I mean, the traffic is moving fairly quickly. We did a traffic study out there, 650 cars a day down a narrow two-lane dirt road for the most part. And the top speeds, I can't remember the average speed, was maybe 40 miles an hour or something like that. But the top speed was 86 to 97 miles an hour. People are going down this dirt road. So the residents came to us in a fairly large group and said, please do something to help us. The noise, the traffic, it's just not a place that we thought we were moving to. There's nothing else out there. The Ure Ranch is there. We have that under option. It's going to be open space. So we had that discussion. We were presented with some options. One was to pave it, which is probably not going to slow the traffic down. It would probably do some good for the dust. And a second solution was put up a crash gate. I think we were inclined just to put up a crash gate and close it for through traffic. And then the developer of Wakara raised a hand and said that would cut off his access. And there's a long history relating to the approval of development at Toohey and what would happen with that 200 South Road, which was the Old Camas Highway. And it crosses from Summit County into Wasatch County and then into Toohey. And at some point, Toohey asked Wasatch County to abandon the road as it entered Toohey. So it's a private road once you get through the private gate at Toohey, but they've been using it as a construction access and as a secondary access to Toohey. So no other private cars are supposed to be going through there. The developer of Wakara thought that they were going to be able to get access through Toohey out to 248, and Toohey ultimately did not reach an agreement with Wakara for that. So you've got big development, a lot of units at Toohey, I think something like 700 units at Wakara, and then some notion that this is going to be Wakara's front door in terms of people coming in and out, because there's no real secondary access, I don't think, as you look at it on the map. So that's what we're trying to figure out. We're going to form a subcommittee with Wasatch County and start trying to tease out this issue and see what solutions we can come to.
Sounds like it's a Wakara's problem, though. I mean, why you would build a development without access is how it even got approved.
Well, I think they approved it. Wasatch County approved it. They didn't think about talking to us because that road had been there. And as Candace Hart said last night, I'm not sure we wouldn't have reached the same kind of conclusion, just looked at it and went, yeah, that seems like a road, that'll be fine. But once we, you know, you've got 700 units driving past a handful of full-time residents in that area and open space. So the impacts are going to be very substantial, and it takes them out right there at the entrance to the Camas Valley. It's not ideal. The developer pointed out that there's a state law that says essentially you can't close a county road if it would eliminate access to a development. So I think given where our state legislature is with on the issue of property rights and on issues relating to development, it could result in litigation, and that's always uncertain.
One of Wakara's proposed solutions apparently is to redesign the road to make it impossible to speed. Would that work?
I don't know. I mean, you know, people lit their hair on fire when we redesigned Kilby Road and made it curve and twist and put some center islands to slow traffic down, and it worked like a charm. And I think that, you know, there were forecasts that it was going to result in incalculable deaths by bicyclists trying to share the road, but so far I think it's serving its purpose. I think we could probably program it. I think it would take something complicated. What I worry about is forecasting not just over the next 3-4 years while they're building with the construction traffic, but overall traffic once the full development is built out. If you improve that road, I think you're going to get a lot more access from Toohey as well. And I just think that the sheer volume out there is something that we've got to consider, and I don't know how we manage all of that. We could slow the traffic down, I'm sure, but I'm not sure that's the only issue that we're looking at.
All right, so you had mentioned this yesterday, just about, yeah, well, we might be able to solve the construction concern now, but what about 10, 20 years down the road?
Yeah, you know, when you think about 700 units, that's 20 times 3, it's 2,100 people. And then Toohey's got, you know, probably a similar number or more or less. That's a lot.
Wakara apparently offering to bear some of the cost of improving the road. Don't you think they would pay for everything to improve the road?
That would be, I think that would certainly be part of the discussion. I think they offered to do that previously. For counties, improving the road is not the be-all and end-all. It's maintaining the road. It's plowing the road. It's doing maintenance on it, the slurry coats, rebuilding the road, all the stuff that it takes. It's very, very expensive over time. We've had enough challenges, I think, as you know, with Silver Creek Road, which is one of those areas that's operated by a special service district. And, you know, they have real challenges trying to maintain that road, challenges as to whether the road is wide enough to be safe. And so, again, long term, in the short term, that probably works. In the long term, the developer may go out of business. It's unclear who would take over that obligation. When it was done, would it be a service area? There are just a lot of questions surrounding how we solve those issues.
All right, so no decision made yesterday. I mean, where does it go from here?
Like I said, we'll form a committee with Wasatch County and just start working through it.
Okay. You know, it feels like elected leaders in the Wasatch back have talked a lot about regional collaboration, but apparently this was the council's first meeting with Wasatch County Council in years. So are you going to start planning more regular scheduling meetings?
I think we will. I think we should. I think we had them. We didn't have them on a quarterly basis, but I think we may have been doing them twice a year previously. And, you know, when we started, I think there was a lot of suspicion in terms of whether we could find common ground. And I think as we started our discussions, we developed that. And oddly enough, we developed it in the area of transportation first, which was probably the thorniest issue when we started our discussions with them. And High Valley Transit and Wasatch County are working incredibly well together in terms of starting a bus system in Wasatch County, which I think is being favorably received. They've started with passing some of their transportation taxes to help expand that. And, you know, I'm very encouraged by that. We have good conversations with them. We're familiar with them. I think the relationships that we developed over the years make it easier for us to have conversations. Shane Scott, our county manager, and Dustin Graybow talk very frequently, and Jana as well. So we have good lines of communication. I think there are just some things where on both sides of the county line, we just were not as thoughtful as we could be. That's not a disparaging comment. It's just we're used to focusing on what's on our side of the line. We have to broaden that a bit and start considering how something we may be doing on our respective sides may affect the other.
All right. Council also held a joint meeting with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Community Development Director Peter Barnes says that the Planning Commission is seeing more and more complex and ambitious projects. Is that a good or a bad thing?
You know, complex and ambitious in a community that's trying to hold on to its values and its identity, I think, is always going to be complicated, and probably you look at it a little side-eyed when it comes across in front of you. They're concerned that they're seeing some of these complicated things, particularly large accessory buildings that may have some residential component, and those accessory buildings are now pretty well protected by state law, because the state fancies that accessory development units can help solve the housing crisis. So part of the issue is, can we restrict those effectively? Legally, I think we can, but can we effectively restrict them from becoming nightly rentals? And they several times mentioned that enforcement is a problem. We have two code enforcement officers. They're incredibly busy. Peter Barnes tells us they're effective, but we could use more.
Are you seeing any kind of restrictions or pressures coming from the state legislature?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the ADUs, legislation was passed last year or the year before, enabling them. I think, you know, you're seeing with the requirements for counties to create and cities to create moderate income housing plans that are very aggressive. And those are, they've taken away, you know, it's odd. They've taken away some tools, as we discussed last night, like the fee in lieu, like inclusive zoning, saying that, you know, if you're going to build a development, you have to have 20% affordable housing, which is what we have in the basin. We don't have that on the east side because it wasn't as much of an issue years ago. They passed this legislation and now we're locked. We can't change our inclusive zoning and we can't put it in place on the east side anymore. So they say they want more affordable housing, but then they come up with this conundrum that says, and by the way, you can't use tools that will effectively bring more affordable housing. So that's the problem. We have, you know, part of what I said last night to the Planning Commission, we talk about affordable housing all the time, and as a two-word term, there's a lot to unpack in there. Who are we building for? How much of it do we want to build? Because if you just say affordable housing and ignore the notion that we're not erasing other parts of the population, so if we're building more residential space for any class, whether it's market rate or affordable, that's population. We're adding more bodies into the basin. We're already having trouble moving. We're already getting complaints about conflicts on trails. We've got our arguments over where certain kinds of bikes can go and other bikes can't go, and we want to add more to that. We've got to be incredibly careful and diligent about where and how we do that.
Planning Commission also reported some tension with Basin Rec, where they give the recreation land in subdivisions that then attract people from out of town, which has impact on residents. So is that a tension or area disagreement that you have heard about from Basin Rec's side of things?
Well, Basin Rec, I think they get irritated when we go out and buy new open space, recreational open space, and hand it to them and say, go ahead, manage this, without giving them resources and budget and other things to do it. They've developed the Ranger program to educate people on trail use and etiquette and to try and minimize some of the conflicts. And that's a symbol of, again, that population increase and the use increase. It's not just the growing population that's crowding our amenities in this community. It's also exactly what the Planning Commission mentioned. It's people coming from the outside, from Salt Lake and other visitors coming in. And we like that. As Chris Conaby said, we like that. It brings money to help us operate the county and operate our cities. But at the same time, it causes more impacts and more costs that we have to incur. So I think they're right. I mean, we have to figure out how we, you know, we've talked about, can we put in place resident-only permits for some amenities? And, you know, I think there's been resistance to that, and some of the resistance to that goes back to code enforcement. How do you police that? How do you know whether somebody's got an adequate pass or not?
Commissioner Bruce Carmichael said he was concerned that Basin Rec did not contact High Valley Transit about the new rec center proposed there for the Silver Creek Village. So I guess it's just a lack of communication there?
Yeah, and again, I think it's probably what I was saying about Wasatch County and Summit County and the way we work together. I think we just have to broaden our vision of everything that we're doing and understand that if we're creating an issue because of something we're developing, or if we're trying to solve an issue, we have to look at how the problems and impacts come at us holistically so that we're not just focusing on one element, we're focusing on multiple elements.
Okay.
We can all do a better job of that.
Planning staff asked the county council if they opposed Camas annexing the Bellaria Farms property on 248 just west of town. Of course, that family, well known on the internet, posting their rural lifestyle on social media. They're looking to open a storefront. Does the county have any reservations about this?
I don't, no. I think, you know, the Camas has had a notion of what their annexation area looks like and how they want to program that. And I think that this is, you know, kind of, if not the leading edge of that, this is a step in that direction. So I think the cities do have the right to do that.
All right. And then the county apparently will own some of the land within that annexation, as you mentioned, I think, since it's purchasing part of the Ewer Ranch. So did the Ewers need to consent?
It's a good question. I think to annex, you've got to get a percentage of the population. That's what we're seeing in West Hills, and that issue's gotten kicked down the road because they didn't have enough population to get the annexation. So, yeah, I do think they've got to go through a formalized process.
All right. And then North Summit Fire Policies, Battalion Chief Tyler Rouser presenting some changes from the North Summit Fire Board that they've been working on. He was saying that more and more of these changes will come before the county council. So, why is it they need changes? I mean, is it related to how the district fights fires or how they govern the administrative and internal matters?
Yeah, it's everything from, you know, how do you manage UAVs? How do you manage air communications in wildfire situations? What, as the chief mentioned last night, if you're on the scene of a medical or another emergency and there's a threat that manifests itself, how do you withdraw from that situation? There are policies for how to approach any number of things, and I think most fire departments have them. North Summit, I don't believe, had a full set of policies, so this is part of the chief's continuing effort to bring the standards at North Summit Fire District up to what's best practices.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Roger, thanks for your time
this morning. Always good to see you.
Roger Armstrong, a member of the Summit County Council. The Park City Board of Education plans to vote at its meeting next Tuesday on the renewal of Superintendent Jill Gilday's employment contract, as well as holding a truth and taxation hearing. Two Parents says that dealing with the employment contract now is not right, and in fact may even be illegal. Joining me now in the studio, I have Parents Josh Mann and Carl Person. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Josh, do you want to start and just give us an update on that petition that the two of you started and why you started it?
Yeah, Leslie. So, yeah, thanks again for having us. And really the impetus behind it, I think, was a interview on KPCW with the school board president, who had mentioned that they were going to vote to renew Dr. Gilday's contract this year. And Carl and I felt that, you know, that wasn't right. We, at that point, two school board members were not going to run for re-election, and since then a third hasn't. And we felt like that didn't represent the democratic process, that the new school board in 2025 should be the people, you know, deciding whether the superintendent's contract should be renewed.
So at this point, what, you have less than 500 signatures when I looked yesterday, Carl?
Yeah, we have about 420 signatures right now. And really, we started this, but now it's really a community movement, and the community has really spoken that they really don't think that they should vote this year and honestly move this up. There's no reason to do it this year.
Well, certainly out of a student population of about 4,000, though, it doesn't sound like a mandate, 400 signatures. Do you see it as?
I definitely do, and we've talked to a lot of people that really feel that there's a lot of issues here and a lot of unanswered questions, so why rush?
And I guess, what do you hope to get out of presenting this petition? Is that what you plan to do then next Tuesday, present the petition to the board?
Well, it depends on when the vote takes place and when the public comment is available. I think what we're really trying to do is to get community pressure on the school board to perhaps make a decision and postpone that. I think at this point, what we're asking people in the community to do is now email the school board. So we've got those 420-ish people have signed the petition. On my ParkRag site, I've had an ability for teachers to anonymously support this, and we have about 65 people who purport to be teachers or staff members who don't want to name their name, because on change.org, you have to provide your name, but a lot of people are scared. They're scared of, you know, what the retribution could be like. So we've got that support, but what we're asking people now to do is email the board directly. And Carl, I think you have that email address.
Yeah, it's pcsd-board@pcschools.us. And like Josh said, we're encouraging everyone to email the school board members and encourage them not to vote this year.
Yeah, and you mentioned, Carl, I mean, that you just feel like there is a rush to do this. And I guess I'm kind of curious why. I mean, the way I understand it is that the superintendent doesn't need to be notified one way or the other until February 1st. I mean, do you know if she's putting pressure on the board to get something done before the new board? Do you know where it's coming from?
We don't. And honestly, it's a little strange because there's no need to do this. We don't really understand the rush, and we really want to make sure that the democratic process plays out, and we consider everything. It's been a very opaque process on performance evaluation. There's been some of the board members that have spoken out that haven't been part of performance evaluation. So we think it should be more of a structured and thought through process.
Hmm. Have you, I know that KPCW has made an effort to try and get a catalog of those performance reviews and haven't seen anything at this point, and it may be protected given that it is personnel, but Have you heard of other prior years?
Yeah, the most I've done is read in the media, I think, from a school board member who said that, you know, he hasn't seen this year's performance review, nor has he seen any of the previous ones. And I guess if that's the case, it's not surprising that KPCW or Carl or I haven't seen them either.
So reading through the contract, the way I understand it is that the school board only needs to notify the superintendent in writing if it does not intend to renew her contract. So why would you even need a vote?
I think that's a great question. I think what they're trying to do is cement that this year and make sure that the superintendent is renewed. I think there is, and again, it's just speculation, that there's an intent and a desire by, you know, a few current members of the board to make sure that Dr. Gilday, you know, continues. And, you know, again, from Carl and I's perspective, we just think that that's unfair and really handcuffs the new board. It's, you know, not being fair to them because they're the person who's going to have to work with the superintendent, and they're the person, you know, or they're the people who should decide who they want to work with.
Yeah, and this is actually a contract that does not expire until June 30th of 2025.
Right, so it's a year more, or almost a year more the way it goes, right? And so what really, by renewing the Dr. Gilday's contract, it's really in some way 2.5-3 years that they'll be, I won't say forced to deal with Dr. Gilday, but that will be the direction unless they decide to move, you know, differently.
Yeah, and as I made the introduction, you too believe the contract is illegal for a couple of reasons, my understanding. First, that there is state code that says a contract cannot be voted on by a lame duck school board. In our case, again, we have three school board members who are not running for a re-election. So in essence, they are lame ducks. Can you explain that code?
Yeah, so within that code, it effectively does define the election period. So after the election, the November election, that they cannot, you know, a lame duck basically cannot vote that in. But what we feel that the intent of the legislature is in that law is saying those people who are no longer going to be part of the school board, should not be the people making the decision on a contract. We think that's the intent. So I think there's likely, that one's a little bit up in the air, but there's likely a legal challenge available there.
Yeah, and then separately is, according to the contract, I quote, in the absence of a written non-renewal, this agreement shall automatically renew at the end of the term. And you believe that another section of state code prohibits the automatic renewal of contracts. Have you had an attorney look into this?
We've had some conversations, and of course we aren't attorneys ourselves, so we'll leave that to the legal professionals, but it's pretty clear from a layperson's perspective that it states that a contract can't include an auto-renewal clause there, and it does. The original contract in 2018 did not, so that was changed, and there's certainly some legal questions here on the legality.
All right, so is there anything you can do about it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, it's a community effort, and I believe that's what we're leaving to others. We've heard that there may be legal challenges to that. But I think what this really says is there's a number of issues, Leslie, where is the contract's auto-renewal provisions legal? Can lame ducks do this? We're hearing that the Utah State Board of Education assessment data is going to come out in September, and it's not going to be favorable. We're hearing that through folks. There's questions about whether the schools will be ready and what construction means and are there overruns. There's just a ton of unanswered questions. And I think in my life, anytime you can have extra time and there's really not a cost to extra time, you take it because you can make the best decision. So why should the school board rush this now when there's a number of unanswered questions and a lot of legal questions even around the contract? Why should they do that now and not get all the information available to make the best possible decision?
Now, have you reached out to school board president Andrew Kaplan and asked him why he's moving ahead with this? Because he's the one who confirmed that they would be doing something on Tuesday.
Yeah, we have not, or I have not. I'm not sure if Carl has.
Yeah,
so,
why not?
Might not be a bad idea. And I've spoken with Andrew many times in the past, and sometimes we agree, oftentimes we disagree, but I will do that. That's a great idea, Leslie.
Yeah. Another difference I wanted to note in the contracts in those 5 years between 2018 and the current contract of 2023 is that the 2018 contract had a unilateral termination by the school board clause that provided for 6 months salary that was extended in the current contract to 12 months. Any idea why? I mean, is that just something that's done in negotiation, I guess, huh?
I would guess so. That's probably up to the school board and Andrew Kaplan, I think, who negotiated that, so.
Okay, so what is it that you want to happen now?
Like we said, I think the board should just take a measured approach here and not vote and rush this, like what Josh is saying. There's so many unanswered questions, and there's no reason to do it this year. We ask everyone to reach out to the school board representatives via that email that I provided previously, pcsd-board@pcschools.us, and make their voice heard.
And I think, Leslie, two of the school board members who are going to be continuing agree with this petition from what they've said in the, you know, media, that they do think it should wait. And so I think those people have said that, and each of the candidates who are running, Eileen Gallagher,
Susan Goldberg,
and those are the folks that are also saying, yeah, let's wait. Let us have the decision. We can make this decision in January. And so the two remaining members and the people who will be members, they're all saying, let us make the decision. And I think it's really a slap in the face to the community if the current board members who are lame ducks in this, you know, situation make this decision.
Yeah, at the same time, though, these lame ducks have a long history with the superintendent. I mean, to think that three new school board members even know the woman, the superintendent, is ludicrous. I mean, how can they judge her and give her the you know, a decision one way or another by February 1st when they've had one school board meeting in January.
Yeah, well, I think, again, listening to, Meredith Reed and Nick talk about this, they think they have information and can make a decision. They've not announced either way how they would go on that, and neither have the incoming folks. But the incoming folks feel like they can get up to speed, before their term actually, or before, January begins, so they can begin to learn early. If you think about it, how much time do you really need to make a decision like that? If you were making that decision, I know having some familiarity with Dr. Gilday probably would help, but you're going to be able to get a lot of the information you need in a short period. So they're confident they can do it. I trust them. Those are the people we've elected, and so those are the people I think we should allow to make the decision.
Okay. Will you be putting your concerns into the record at next week's school board meeting?
We definitely will.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you two want to say?
No, I think, Leslie, I just wanted to wrap up. On change.org, they allow you to make a comment, and I think this comment sums up things best. A person named Heidi L. said, let the incoming school board decide whether to renew or contract. If the current board renews the contract, it will put a stamp of approval on the toxic dysfunction of current leadership and a stain on their own personal legacies. And so I think that sums up what a lot of the community is feeling. And so Carl and I are just hoping that we can come together as a community and encourage the school board not to vote next week or this year on renewing the contract.
All right, because there's at least another meeting or two after this one, yeah.
There definitely are, yeah.
Okay, and how would people find that petition?
So we've actually posted, it's a little hard to find it out on change.org, so if you go to parkrag.com, we posted a link at the top of that will provide a link to the petition and also that email address if somebody wants that.
Okay. Thank you. That's Carl Person and Josh Mann. Well, the Sage Mountain Sanctuary in Browns Canyon hosting a barn-raising fundraiser. And in the studio with details, I have Lauren Lockey from Sage Mountain. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First, maybe tell us, what is Sage Mountain Sanctuary?
Sage Mountain Sanctuary, we are a nonprofit organization that provides sanctuary and advocacy for rescued farm animals, including pigs, goats, sheep, turkeys, chickens, and cows. Right now we have about 40 animals out there.
Okay, and then when you look at your annual budget, I mean, you're the one taking care of all of these?
Yeah,
animals?
We do have volunteers, which, by the way, we need more volunteers. So if you're interested, please contact us. And then we also have a few employees out there. And yeah, so they need to be fed twice a day and cleaning. And one of the reasons we're doing this fundraiser is to build the barn at Sage Mountain. So this will be, this has been needed for a very long time.
Yeah. So how many acres do you have out there?
We have 60 acres, and the cows have about 100 acres. So we are able to use the neighboring field there for them as well.
Okay. So not only the feed and the time that it takes to take care of all of these animals, but I'm guessing vet bills as well?
Yeah, that definitely vet bills. Vet's a big one. The feed and vet are probably the biggest there. So yeah, it's not very cheap, but it's worth it. And when people come out there, it definitely changes people in a very good, positive way. So
yeah. Where do the animals come from?
So most of them, they all have very different stories. So I can tell the story about our very first two pigs, Pony Boy and Wilma Jean. Pony Boy escaped a pretty large factory farm in California, and Wilma Jean was raised on a smaller family farm, and the father of the farmer grew really close to Wilma and started to see her as an individual, and decided to stop their small family business and send her to sanctuary. We have another pig that fell off a transport truck. He was on his way to a finishing barn. We have some turkeys from a larger factory farm. Some of our cows come from what's similar to a 4-H program, where these kids are connected to these animals at a very young age. And they grow very close to them, and they become their very good friends, and decide that, once they know they're going to be going to auction or to slaughter, they don't want that to happen to their friends. So they reach out to us, or they tell their parents to reach out to us. So those are some of the stories. We have a cow that came from, she also escaped a larger farm and was actually wild for quite a while. And we didn't know that she was pregnant when she arrived. So she gave birth to Francis, and they now live happily out there on the sanctuary.
All right. So as you mentioned, you are in need of a barn. You don't have any shelter out there, huh?
We do have shelters. Yes, we do have shelters. They've been great, but we have, as you all know, the winters have been very challenging, and we need more space for the animals too. So, and something that's a little bit safer for not only the animals, but also for our employees, for our volunteers. So this barn is gonna be, it's gonna house all the animals, as well as have a room for our volunteers and for our employees to take a break. Right now we don't have that. It's gonna have a bathroom, which is definitely in need. It's gonna house all the feed, hay. We'll have space for if an animal is hurt or needs to be quarantined. We have like a vet, you know, stall for that particular animal. So yes, this is very much needed, and this is why we are doing this fundraiser to at least get some of the funding for this barn. So it's a big project.
Yeah, how big of a barn is it?
It's pretty big. If you come out there, you'll see it takes up pretty much the entire space between the shelters that we have now and the further pasture. So I don't have exact on me the square footage right now, but it's big. It's definitely a big spot.
So have you started construction? No.
Yes. So it has been excavated out there. So we do have the, it's a big construction zone out there right now. That's why for the fundraiser, we will be in a different part of the sanctuary. So we'll be up towards the upper pasture. But it'll be great. So people can still see, you know, where it's going to be. And that's why I think that's the main thing, is just come out and see where the barn's going to be and come out and see the animals and see why this is definitely needed.
Okay, so this is the fundraiser is, I think you're calling it your plant-based palooza?
Yeah, plant-based palooza. Okay. Yeah, it's on August 24th. And it's from 5 to 10. Tickets are online. And we'll have music by Hannah Kamler. We're going to have Blatches. They're going to provide the food out there. We do our silent auction, so many different businesses and artists are donating. And then we do our sponsor auction, which is the big one where you can sponsor an animal and bid to sponsor an animal. I think the main thing for us is just to meet these animals. I mean, every time people come out there, like just last night we had some visitors out there, and the girl, the daughter of the family, she's I think 12 or 14 years old, left there saying she didn't want to leave these pigs, and she's like, I will never eat bacon again. So these kinds of things, these stories of people meeting these animals, and we have to, you know, ask the question why we, you know, we love our dogs and cats so much, which I do as well, but then, you know, these pigs are treated and slaughtered every year, millions. So that's our main mission, is for people to come out and to connect with these animals like we do with our pets at home.
How much are you hoping to raise?
We hope to raise $50,000 this year. Last year we raised $56,000. So if we could do more, that would be amazing.
Yeah, and will that just go directly then toward the barn?
It will go toward the barn, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. How much are tickets?
They are $90, I think, for adult. I think $45 for kids. It's all there on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, when will that barn get finished? I mean, is it kind of like on hold till you get more money?
Well, we're hoping August of next year, but you know how that goes. It's always longer than you expect, but that is our goal.
Okay. All right. You also have other events that take place out
yes,
there.
Yes.
Tell us about some of those.
So we have Wind Down Yoga, which is every Tuesday, which has been awesome. Tuesdays at 6 o'clock. I teach about a 40-minute class, and then we walk around with the animals, drinking wine or sparkling water. If you're lucky, you get to hang out during the sunset with all the pigs who love watching the sunset as well. And then we also have volunteer day every Saturday from 9 to 11, group volunteer day, which is welcome for kids as well, as long as you're accompanied by an adult. We also offer volunteer opportunities throughout the week. So if you want to do your own shift, you just reach out to us and get a training on that and how to feed and how to clean. And like I said, we would love for people to volunteer.
Okay. Where is the sanctuary located? I said Browns Canyon, but coming from Park City.
If you're coming from Park City, you go out towards Peoa, Oakley. You'll turn left on Browns Canyon Road. And we're about 3 miles down on the right. So before you would get to Nuzzles, there's no signage on the road or anything, but we are back there.
Okay. And the website then is?
It's Sage Mountain, but you abbreviate mountainmtn.org.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Lauren?
That's it. I think our main thing is for people to come out there. So please come out there and visit us. Please come out and volunteer. Please come to Palooza, meet these animals, and you'll see why we are doing what we are doing.
Okay. People do need to bring their own chairs.
Yes. Bring your chairs, blankets. If you have, hats, I don't know what the weather is going to be at that point. It could be cold, who knows? Bring some, a hat if you need that. And then also if you want to have your own beverages, alcoholic beverages, then you are responsible for bringing that as well.
Okay. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you so much.
It's Lauren Locke with Sage Mountain Sanctuary. Well, the Wasatch Backs real estate market continues to trend as a desirable mountain location. Here's more from the second quarter stats. Both the numbers of sales and median home prices increased year over year, driven by demand from out-of-state buyers and a limited supply of inventory. Park City Board of Realtors President John Schumann says that the numbers show steady growth.
Everything continues to increase slightly. As you've seen, the number of units sold quarter over quarter was 20% higher than 2023. We look back what normal conditions are, we're coming back to that kind of pseudo-normal range.
And that pseudo-normal range, he says, was between the years of 2013 and 2019 before the pandemic really skewed the market. Bronson Calder, president of the Park City Multiple Listing Services, noticed that the dynamics of the market are changing. Whereas Park City and the Snyderville Basin used to represent the bulk of sales, it's now the newer product in Wasatch County that is really making a difference.
The Heber Valley and the Jordanelle area have added significantly to our dollar volume in those statistics. And I think that trend's gonna continue to change. A lot of growth in those areas, a lot of new inventory, a lot of really high-priced inventory. And so I suspect as we move into the future that those areas are gonna continue to have a pretty significant impact on our statistics.
However, the numbers do show that Park City and the Snyderville Basin together still make up 66% of the sales volume. That's down from 75% of the volume pre-pandemic. Today, the Jordanelle and Heber Valley areas make up about 29% of the overall sales volume. Promontory and the Colony now represent the area's most expensive home prices. The median home prices within the Park City limits is just under $4 million. The median price of a Promontory home is now above $4.6 million, and the Canyons Village, which includes the Colony, held on to the crown of most expensive area with a median price now more of $11 million. A home in Promontory's Pinnacle neighborhood, Calder says, recently sold for $27 million. It has all of the bells and whistles, including an internal oxygen system that pumps oxygen into the home. Some good news for entry-level buyers is that the mortgage rates, he says, have come down a bit.
I talked to a lender yesterday, and they had product available in the low 6% for adjustable rate mortgages, and I think 30-year fixes run right about 6.5% right now, and so that's down significantly, and that no question will continue to bring buyers off the fence and back into our market. We're starting to see that.
Still, Schumann says it's important to note that 60% of the buyers in this market pay for their real estate with cash. And Park City billionaire Matthew Prince's proposed home on Treasure Hill could get a key approval from city planners today. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on that.
Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince and his wife Tatiana are planning to build a 10,000 square foot home on King Road overlooking Main Street. At City Hall Thursday, planners will go through a historic district design review to ensure the home complies with the historic nature and character of Old Town. A consultant hired by the city determined that the home's modern industrial architectural style is appropriate for the area. Prince's team has repeatedly discussed how the project was modeled after historic mining structures in town. One issue planners have noted involves a portion of the home's roof. It must be removed to match the massing of other nearby homes. Along with other conditions, the city planning director could move to approve the home Thursday. It could also be denied, or the decision could be delayed to a later date. The historic review is procedural and does not involve the City Council or Planning Commission.
And after that historic design review, the last step would be to get building permits from the city.